The Free Library of Philadelphia is proud to present a podcast from our award-winning author events series, recorded live at the Parkway Central Library on the Benjamin Franklin Parkway. To learn more about the Free Library, our unique and inspiring collections, and how your contribution can help our programs and services for the community, please visit freelibrary.org.
Tonight, I have the pleasure of welcoming Patty Smith to the Free Library of Philadelphia. We are gathered to celebrate her book, Just Kids, which won the 2010 National Book Award this fall. Yay. This book fulfills a promise that she made to her friend, the photographer Robert Mapplethorpe, to tell their story. And it's a beautiful book. It's an evocative, immersive memoir of their friendship and artistic coming of age in the late 60s and 70s in New York. When she received the National Book Award, Patty Smith said, "I dreamed of having a book of my own, or writing one that I could put on a shelf. Please, no matter how we advance technologically, please don't abandon the book." So, Patty Smith has written a beautiful book, and she's here tonight to share it with us. Please join me in welcoming Patty Smith.
Thank you. Hello, everybody. Can everybody hear us? Is this fine? Okay. It's really great to be here. I always get excited when I come to Philadelphia because I am a Philly girl. And also to support the library. I did a lot of time in the library when I was a young girl and a teenager, and so I'm always very, very happy to come back to the library and hopefully do my part. So I thought that Philadelphia was the first place that I saw art in person at the beautiful Philadelphia Museum of Art, and one of the most beautiful museums in all of the world. And it was there in the Philadelphia Museum of Art at the age of 12 that I decided I wanted to be an artist. And it was also in the Franklin Institute that I decided I did not want to be a doctor. I think it was going inside of the newly constructed human heart. So I thought a good place to start would be Philadelphia. When I was 12 years old, my father took us on a rare excursion to the Museum of Art in Philadelphia. My parents worked very hard, and taking four children on a bus to Philadelphia from South Jersey was exhausting and expensive. It was the only such outing we made as a family. The only one. Marking the first time I came face to face with art, I felt a sense of physical identification with the long, languorous Modiglianis, was moved by the elegantly still subjects of Sargent and Thomas Eakins, and dazzled by the light that emanated from the Impressionists. But it was the work in a hall devoted to Picasso, from his Harlequins to Cubism, that pierced me the most. His brutal confidence took my breath away. My father admired the draftsmanship and symbolism in the work of Salvador Dali, yet he found no merit in Picasso, which led us to our first serious disagreement. The second was over the Rolling Stones. My mother busied herself rounding up my siblings who were sliding the slick surface of the marble floors. Incertain, as we filed from the great staircase, it must have appeared that I was the same as ever, a moping 12-year-old, all arms and legs. But secretly, I knew I had been transformed, moved by the revelation that human beings created art, that to be an artist was to see what others could not. I had no proof that I had the stuff to be an artist, though I hungered to be one. I imagined that I felt the calling and prayed that it be so. But one night, while watching The Song of Bernadette with Jennifer Jones, I was struck that the young saint did not ask to be called. It was the Mother Superior who desired sanctity, even as Bernadette, a humble peasant girl, became the chosen one. This worried me. I wondered if I hadn't been called at all. I didn't mind the misery of a vocation, but I dreaded not being called one. I shut up several inches. I was nearly 5'8" and barely 100 pounds. They're coming after me. At 14, I was no longer the commander of a small yet loyal army, but a skinny loser, the subject of much ridicule as I perched on the lowest rung of high school's social ladder. I immersed myself in books and rock and roll, the adolescent salvation of 1961. My parents worked at night. After doing my chores and homework, my brother Todd, my sister Linda, and I would dance to the likes of James Brown, the Shirelles, and Hank Ballard and the Midnighters. With all modesty, I can say we were as good as the dance floor as we were in battle. And we were very good in battle. Of course, we're from South Jersey, and sorry, that's where the best dancers come from. I drew, I danced, I wrote poems. My mother gave me, on my 16th birthday, a copy of The Fabulous Life of Diego Rivera. I was transported. She got it as a remainder. I remember it was like this thick, and this was my birthday present. I still have it. It's such a great book. But it had a sticker on it, reduced to 198. I was transported by the scope of his murals, descriptions of his travels and tribulations, his loves and labor. That summer, I got a job in a non-union factory, inspecting handlebars for tricycles. It was a wretched place to work. I escaped into daydreams as I did my piecework. I longed to enter the fraternity of the artist, the hunger, their manner of dress, their process and prayers. I'd brag that I was going to be an artist mistress someday. Nothing seemed more romantic to my young mind. I imagined myself as Frida to Diego, both muse and maker. I dreamed of meeting an artist to love and support and to work with side by side. Robert Michael Mapplethorpe was born on Monday, November 4th, 1946. He was raised in Floral Park, Long Island, the third of six children. He was a mischievous little boy whose carefree youth was delicately tinged with a fascination for beauty. His young eyes stored away each play of light, the sparkle of a jewel, the rich dressing of an altar, the burnish of a gold-toned saxophone, or a field of blue stars. He was gracious and shy, with a precise nature. He contained, even at an early age, a stirring and a desire to stir. The light fell upon the pages of his coloring book, across his child's hands. I have to stop for a second. When I wrote this book, I didn't talk to anybody. Well, I talked to two people. I talked to one of Robert's boyfriends who was in this book, David Crowland, because he had an excellent eye for detail, and I could ask him about specific things. And I talked to Robert's older sister, who really didn't have much to say about Robert when he was little. There were seven kids, and she was a teenager. but the main thing she talked about was how he drove all the siblings crazy, seven of them, by coloring in weird ways. Coloring excited him. Not the act of filling in spaces, but choosing colors, ones that no one else would select. In the green of the hills, he saw red, purple snow, green skin, silver sun. He liked the effect it had on others, that it disturbed his siblings. He discovered he had the talent for sketching. He was a natural draftsman, and secretly he twisted and abstracted his images, feeling his growing powers. He was an artist, and he knew it. It was not a childish notion. He merely acknowledged what he was. The light fell upon the components of Robert's beloved jewelry kit, upon the bottles of enamel and tiny brushes. His fingers were nimble. He delighted in his ability to piece together and decorate brooches for his mother. He wasn't concerned that this was a girl's pursuit, that a jewelry-making kit was a traditional Christmas gift for girls. His older brother, a whiz at sports, would snicker at him as he worked. His mother, Joan, chain-smoked and admired the sight of her son sitting at the table, dutifully stringing yet another necklace of Indian beads for her. They were precursors of the necklaces he would later adorn himself with, having broken from his father, leaving his Catholic, commercial, and military options behind in the wake of LSD and a commitment to live for art alone. So in 1967, I left South Jersey. I did stop in Philadelphia first. I got a job in an iTech factory, shooting material for textbooks. And the summer of 67 was kind of rough because they were closing the New York shipyard and everybody was losing their jobs. So the young kids were the first to go to give older people a chance to work. So I got laid off and I needed a job. So I went to New York City. I went to New York City because there were a lot of bookstores there. And that was my goal, to work in a bookstore. So I wanted to tell you, I went to New York City, and in the summer of 1967, I met Robert. And after two or three meetings, we just hit it off so well and wound up getting an apartment together near Pratt Institute. I went back to South Jersey and retrieved my books and clothing. While I was gone, Robert hung his drawings and draped the walls with Indian cloth. He dressed the mantle with religious artifacts, candles, and souvenirs from the Day of the Dead, arranging them as if they were sacred objects on an altar. Finally, he prepared a little study area with me, with a little work table and a frayed magic carpet. He found it on the street. In 1967, you could find anything on the street. It's like magic. We realized we didn't have a bed. We went out on trash night, and there was a mattress. My treasured objects were mingled with the laundry. My work area was a jumble of manuscript pages and musty classics, broken toys and talismans. I tacked pictures of Rimbaud and Bob Dylan and Lada Lenya, Piaf, Genet, and John Lennon over at my makeshift desk where I arranged my quills, my inkwell, my notebooks, and my monastic mess. When I came to New York, I had brought a few colored pencils and a wood slate to draw on. Robert and I would work side by side for hours in a state of mutual concentration. We hadn't much money, but we were happy. Robert worked part-time and took care of the apartment. I did the laundry and made our meals, which were very limited. My specialty was lettuce soup. We had our work and we had each other. We didn't have much money to go to concerts or movies or to buy new records, but we played the ones we had over and over. We listened to My Madam Butterfly, as sung by Eleanor Stieber, A Love Supreme, Between the Buttons, Joan Baez, and Blonde on Blonde. Robert introduced me to his favorites, Vanilla Fudge. This Vanilla Fudge record was the bane of my existence. And we didn't have much money, and every once in a while, Robert would take LSD. I always knew that he had taken it, even though he didn't tell me, because out came the Vanilla Fudge record. And he'd play it over and over. He also liked Tim Buckley, Tim Hardin, and A History of Motown. They provided the backdrop for our nights of communal joy. One Indian summer day, we dressed in our favorite things, me and my beatnik sandals and ragged scarves, and Robert with his love beads and sheepskin vest. We took the subway to West 4th Street and spent the afternoon in Washington Square. We shared coffee from a thermos, watched the stream of tourists and stoners and folk singers, agitated revolutionaries distributing anti-war leaflets, chess players drawing a crowd of their own. Everyone coexisted within the continuous drone of verbal diatribes, bongos, and barking dogs. We were walking toward the fountain, the epicenter of activity, when an older couple stopped and openly observed us. Robert enjoyed being noticed, and he affectionately squeezed my hand. "Oh, take their picture," said the woman to her bemused husband. "I think they're artists." "Oh, go on," he shrugged. "They're just kids." That little episode, I had written a notebook, and wrote that in a notebook in 1967, never imagining that someday it would be the title of a little book for Robert. Robert and I went through a lot of things in Brooklyn. We evolved as human beings, as artists. Robert had a lot of soul-searching to do about his sexual persuasion. And we went through all of these things together because we had something far greater than a relationship or a physical relationship to save and to treasure. We had the confidence and belief in one another, in one another's work. And often people ask me, well, how did you get through that? You know, how did you two stay together? Because we did. We had something precious that was worth fighting for. And Robert and I went to the Chelsea Hotel in 1969. And there was a little something I wanted to read from then. It was really funny. We moved to the Chelsea Hotel in a couple of days after the moon landing. And we were so immersed in our own problems and trying to get money to eat, to live. We hardly even noticed that happened. And then in August, we had such a tiny little room. We had the smallest room at the Chelsea. And I came down one evening looking around to see if anybody was there. And there was a bar. It's still there, the El Quixote bar, adjacent to the Chelsea. And I was going in there to see if any of our friends were in there. And I walked in, and it's like at one table, it was Janis Joplin and all of her band. Another table was like Country Joe and the Fish or something. And another table was Grace Slick and all of Jefferson Airplane. And then toward the back, Jimi Hendrix was there with some blonde Eaton. And the whole place was filled with these people. And I was like, what the hell happened? You know, it was Woodstock. And I guess it was either beginning or ending. I can't remember, but everybody was staying at the Chelsea, and that's where we lived. So people often ask me, you know, did I ever go to Woodstock? Of course, I didn't have the money. I was working in a bookstore, and I didn't have the money or time to go to Woodstock. But I always tell them that, no, Woodstock came to me. It's wonderful to find. Here's a little episode, little Chelsea Hotel episode. Horn and Hard Art. Do you remember Horn and Hard Art? I just love that place. Horn and Hard Art, the queen of the automats, was just past the fish and tackle shop near the Chelsea. The routine was to get a seat and a tray, then go to the back wall where there were rows of little windows. You would slip some coins in a slot, open the glass hatch, and extract a sandwich or fresh apple pie. It was a real Tex Avery eatery. I love Philadelphia. Nobody gets that, you know. Winky Dink? No, no, it's not. Bertie the Bunyip. Someday I'm going to write another book, and there's going to be at least 3 pages about Bertie the Bunyip. Yes, Fussy and Gussie. My favorite was chicken pot pie, or cheese and mustard with lettuce on a poppy seed roll. Robert liked their 2 specialties, baked macaroni and cheese and chocolate milk. Ugh. And he'd order them at the same time. I was always hungry. I metabolized my food quickly. Robert could go without eating much longer than me. If we were out of money, we just didn't eat. Robert might be able to function even if he got a little shaky, but I would feel like I was going to pass out. One drizzly afternoon, I had a hankering for one of those cheese and lettuce sandwiches. I went through all our belongings and found exactly 55 cents. I slipped on my gray trench coat and my Mayakovsky cap, and I headed to the automat. You have to dress for everything, you know. I got my tray, and I slipped in my coins, but the window wouldn't open. I tried again without luck, and then I noticed the price had gone up to 65 cents. Yeah, I know. I was really, it was so sad. I was disappointed, to say the least, when I heard a voice say, "Can I help?" I turned around, and it was Allen Ginsberg. We had never met, but there was no mistake in the face of one of our great poets and activists. I looked into those intense dark eyes, punctuated by his dark curly beard, and I just nodded. Alan added the extra dime and also stood me for a cup of coffee. I wordlessly followed him to this table, and then I plowed into the sandwich. Alan introduced himself. He was talking about Walt Whitman, and I mentioned I was raised near Camden, where Whitman was buried, when he leaned forward and looked at me intently. "Are you a girl?" he said. "Yeah," I said. "Is that a problem?" He just laughed. "I'm sorry. I took you for a very pretty boy." I got the picture immediately. "Well, does that mean I got to return the sandwich?" "No, enjoy it. It was my mistake." He told me he was writing a long elegy for Jack Kerouac, who had recently passed away. 3 days after Rimbaud's birthday, I said solemnly. I shook his hand, and we parted company. Sometime later, Alan became my good friend and teacher. We often reminisced about our first encounter, and he once asked hell, I would describe how we met. I would say, you fed me when I was hungry. And he did. Well, Robert and I made it through the 60s. This is a little vignette. It snowed on Christmas night. Robert and I walked to Times Square to see the white billboard proclaiming, "War is over if you want it. Happy Christmas from John and Yoko." It hung above the bookstall where Robert bought most of his men's magazines, between Child's and Benedict's, two all-night diners. Looking up, we were struck by the ingenuous humanity of this New York City tableau. Robert took my hand, and as the snow swirled around us, I glanced at his face. He narrowed his eyes and nodded in affirmation, impressed to see artists take on 42nd Street. For me, it was the message. For Robert, the medium. Newly inspired, we walked back to 23rd Street to look at our space. The necklaces we had made hung on hooks, and he had tacked up some of our drawings. We stood at the window and looked at the snow falling beyond the fluorescent oasis sign with its squiggly palm tree. "Look," he said, "it's snowing in the desert." I thought about a scene in Howard Hawks' movie Scarface, where Paul Muni and his girl are looking out the window at a neon sign that said, "The world is yours." Robert squeezed my hand. The 60s were coming to an end. Robert and I celebrated our birthdays. Robert turned 23. Then I turned 23, the perfect prime number. Robert made me a tie rack with the image of the Virgin Mary. I gave him 7 silver skulls on a length of leather. He wore the skulls. I wore a tie. We felt ready for the 70s. "It's our decade," he said. Sorry. Robert, it's very funny the way our vocations went. I used to like to sing little songs to Robert at night, you know, sort of like bedtime stories. I would sing him little songs. And he always used to think that I should make records, and I'd say, "I don't want to be a singer." And I used to always think that Robert should take photographs to work, because he did collages and installations, and he often used images from magazines. And I used to say, "You should take your own pictures." And he said, "No, I don't want to be a photographer." But sooner or later he started, and he started with a simple Polaroid Land camera around somewhere in the middle of 1970. But we didn't really have any money. I was the breadwinner, and I made about $65 a week at Scribner's bookstore, and film cost about $3 a pack, and that was kind of expensive then. So it took him a while to get started because of lack of money, but it didn't take him long to, as soon as he started taking pictures, he had it, just like that, because he understood composition and light. And I always think, because he had such, we had so little money, every picture, he had 10 shots, and each one had to be meaningful. And, and they had to be finished. It wasn't something you fix later in Photoshop. It was done. It was there. The light was there. The composition was there. So, the Polaroid camera in Robert's hands, the physical act, a jerk of the wrist, the snapping sound when pulling the shot, and the anticipation, 60 seconds to see what he got. The immediacy of the process suited his temperament. At first, he toyed with the camera. He wasn't totally convinced that it was for him, and film was expensive. 10 pictures for about $3, a substantial amount in 1971. For instance, For $3, you could buy 12 packs of cigarettes, a couple of lunches. And if it was for me, that would mean 60 cups of coffee. I was Robert's first model. He was comfortable with me, and he needed time to get his technique down. The mechanics of the camera was simple, but the options were limited. We took countless photographs. At first, he had to rein me in. I would always try to get him to take pictures like the album cover for Bringing It All Back Home, where Bob Dylan surrounds himself with his favorite things. I arranged my dice, my Sinner's license plate, my Kurt Vile album, my copy of Blonde on Blonde, and I wore a black slip like Anna Mignani. He said, "It's too cluttered with crap. Just let me take your picture." But I like this stuff. We're not making an album cover, we're making art. "I hate art," I yelled, and he took the picture. That particular picture I gave to the Museum of Modern Art. It's just a little picture like this, and I'm like... He was his own first male subject. No one could question him shooting himself. He had control. He figured out what he wanted to see by seeing himself. He was pleased with his first images, but the cost of film was so high that he was obliged to set the camera aside, but not for long. Robert spent a lot of time improving our space and the presentation of his work. Truthfully, we were involved in so many things that the question of Robert's sexual persuasion was not our immediate concern. One afternoon, Gregory Corso came in to visit us. He called on Robert first, and they had a smoke. That meant, well, you have to understand, when Robert had a smoke, that meant everything that he did took 7 times longer than usual. It was like this, Gregory say, "Oh, I'll go have a smoke with Robert, and I'll come back in 10 minutes. But I knew that would be like 7 hours. But... where am I? Okay. Anyway, they had a smoke, and by the time Gregory came to visit me, the sun was going down. I was sitting on the floor typing on my Remington. Gregory came in and panned the room slowly. There were piss cups and broken toys. And the reason there were piss cups, of course, is we didn't have a bathroom. Robert and I didn't have a bathroom for years. In fact, I don't think we ever had a bathroom while we were living together. We had one briefly in Brooklyn, but as soon as we came to New York, we never had a bathroom. At the Chelsea Hotel, we had a bathroom in the hall. And then when we had a bigger space, there was no bathroom at all. And sometimes, because it was only about a block from the Chelsea, you know, I'd have to go to the bathroom. I'd have to walk all the way to Chelsea and go in one of the public bathrooms. But, you know, if it's 3 o'clock in the morning and it's, you know, 4 below 0, you don't really want to get up and go to the Chelsea Hotel to go to the bathroom. It's sort of like, think of it like an outhouse to go. "This is my kind of place," said Gregory. I dragged over an old armchair. Gregory lit a cigarette and read from my pile of abandoned poems, drifting off, making a little burn mark on the arm of the chair. I poured some of my Nescafe over it. He awoke and drank the rest. I staked him a few bucks for his most precious needs. And as he was leaving, he looked at an old French crucifix hanging over my mat. Beneath the feet of Christ was a skull embellished with the words, "Memento Mori." "It means, remember we are mortal," said Gregory. "But poetry is not." I just nodded. When he left, I sat down in my chair and ran my fingers over the cigarette burn, a fresh scar left by one of our greatest poets. Gregory would often spell trouble and might even wreak havoc, yet he gave us a body of work, pure as a newborn fawn. Thanks. In 1975, I signed with Clive Davis on his new label, Arista Records. And to show Clive's diversity, his first artist that he signed was Barry Manilow. The second was Melissa Manchester, and I was the third. And of course, Robert took the cover, and I thought I would read a little bit about the making of the cover. I rolled out of bed, and I noticed it was late. I raced through my morning ritual, going around the corner to the Moroccan bakery, grabbing a crusty roll, a sprig of fresh mint, and some anchovies. I came back and boiled water, stuffing the pot with mint. I poured olive oil over the open roll, rinsed the anchovies, laid them inside, sprinkled on some cayenne pepper. I was reading Paul Bowles at the time. I poured a glass of tea, and I thought better of wearing my shirt. See, I had a white shirt on, and I had promised Robert, we didn't plan what the record would look like or what the cover would look like. He just said he would like it if I wore one of my white shirts, but he said, don't get any stains on it. No spaghetti sauce and no olive oil. So that was my one promise, that I would have a clean shirt. Not necessarily ironed, but at least cleaned. So I took it off, knowing I'd get olive oil on the front of it. Later, Robert came to fetch me. He was worried because it was very overcast. I finished getting dressed. Black pants, white Lazelle socks, black Capizios. I added my favorite ribbon, and Robert brushed the crumbs off my black jacket. We hit the street. He was hungry, but he refused to eat my anchovy sandwiches. He hated them. He'd say, you know, dirty little fishes, and he wouldn't eat my... Actually, after the lettuce soup, he sort of, like, soured on my cooking. We ended up by having grits and eggs at the pink teacup. The day kept slipping away. It was cloudy and dark, and Robert kept watching for the sun. See, we were going to shoot it at his patron Sam Wagstaff's apartment, which had beautiful natural light. And the way there was a window there and the way the light always came in, it always threw this triangle of light. And he had this idea that he just wanted me to stand in this triangle of light. But there was no sun. So we had to shoot it that day. You know, Robert didn't have any assistants or nothing like that. We just, you know, I got up and we had to take the picture. And so finally, in late afternoon, it started to clear. We crossed Washington Square just as the sky threatened to darken again. Robert became worried that we were going to miss the light, and we ran the rest of the way to 15th Avenue. The light was fading. He had no assistant. We never talked about what we would do or what it would look like. He would shoot it, and I would be shot. I had my look in mind. He had his light in mind. That is all. Sam's apartment was Spartan, all white, nearly empty, with a tall avocado tree by the window overlooking Fifth Avenue. Robert placed me by the triangle of light. His hands trembled slightly as he readied to shoot, and I stood. Robert, when he got a little nervous, his hands would just tremble like that. And sometimes if he was really nervous, he'd drop his light meter. And I think he dropped it that day, and he dropped it when we did Dream of Life. So two album covers, two broken light meters. Sorry. The clouds kept moving back and forth. Something happened with the light meter, and he dropped it, and then he became slightly agitated. He took a few shots. He abandoned the light meter. A cloud went by, and the triangle disappeared. He said, "You know, I really like the whiteness of the shirt. Can you take the jacket off?" I flung my jacket over my shoulder, Frank Sinatra style. I was full of references. He was full of light and shadow. "The triangle is back," he said. He took a few more shots. "I got it." "How do you know?" "I just know." He took 12 pictures that day. Within a few days, he showed me the contact sheet. "This one has the magic," he said. "When I look at it now, I never see me. I see us." I always think of that when, you know, people want to take my picture, you know, and it's like, especially photographers these days, they bring like a computer, 9 cameras, a lens like that looks like the Empire State Building, you know, it's like, and they take, you know, 750 pictures. So what I do after, when it comes to 13, I always say, you know, the horse's cover was already done. Oh, this is, podium was presented here in memory of Donald H. Hunt. One late afternoon, Robert and I were walking down 8th Street when we heard "Because the Night" blasting from one storefront after another. It was my collaboration with Bruce Springsteen, the single from the album Easter. Robert was my first listener after we recorded the song. I had a reason for that. It was what he always wanted for me. In the summer of 1978, it rose to number 13 on the top 40 charts, fulfilling Robert's dream that I would one day have a hit record. Robert was smiling and walking in rhythm with the song. He took out a cigarette and lit it. We had been through a lot since he first rescued me from the science fiction writer. Have to buy the book. It's a harrowing tale. And we shared a chocolate egg cream on a stoop near Tompkins Square. Robert was unabashedly proud of my success. What he wanted for himself, he wanted for us both. He exhaled a perfect stream of smoke and spoke in a tone he only used with me, a bemused scolding, admiration without envy, our brother-sister language. "Patty," he drawled, "you got famous before me." So there's one more thing I wanted to read, but I thought that might be nice to try a little experiment. And if you can help, you can join in. Okay, I need to try this. It's something I can't play because it has too many chords. Much too complicated for me. I'm like good with Hank Williams songs or anything that's in C, D, A, and E. And a G. Okay. "Take me now, baby, here as I am. Pull me close, try and understand. Desire is hunger, is the fire I breathe. Love is a banquet on which we feed. Come on now, try and understand the way I feel under your command. Take me now, come undercover. They can't hurt you now, can't hurt you now, can't hurt you now. Because the night belongs to lovers, because the night belongs to us, because the night belongs to lovers, because the night belongs to us. Have I doubt when I'm alone? Love is a ring, the telephone. Love is an angel disguised as lust, here in our bed until the morning comes. But come on now, try and understand the way I feel under your command. Take me now as the sun descends. They can't hurt you now, can't hurt you now, can't hurt you now. Because the night belongs to lovers, because the night belongs to us, because the night belongs to lovers, because the night belongs to us. Now here's the part where Lenny Kaye plays a solo on electric guitar, and everybody gets excited, and everybody starts shouting, and then I come back again. Although you're filled with doubt, the vicious circle turns and burns without you. Oh, I cannot live, forgive the yearning, burning. I believe it's time to feel, reveal, and touch me now, touch me now, touch me now. Hey, because the night belongs to lovers, because the night belongs to us, because the night belongs to lovers, because the night belongs to us, because we believe in the night we're lovers, because we believe in the night we trust, because the night belongs to lovers, because the night belongs to love. Thank you. Thanks. Thank you. Well, thanks. I know that some of you knew the lyrics better than me. It's always embarrassing. Sorry. So I wanted to read one more little piece, and then we could do some, you could ask some questions if you want, and then we'll continue on. So this is a little letter that I wrote to Robert a few days before he passed away, and he never had a chance to read it. Dear Robert, often as I lie awake, I wonder if you are also lying awake. Are you in pain or feeling alone? You drew me from the darkest period of my young life, shared with me the sacred mystery of what it is to be an artist. I learned to see through you and never compose a line or draw a curve that does not come from the knowledge I derived in our precious time together. Your work, coming from a fluid source, can be traced to the naked song of your youth. You spoke then of holding hands with God. Remember, through everything, you have always held that hand. Grip it hard, Robert, and don't let go. The other afternoon, when you fell asleep on my shoulder, I drifted off too. But before I did, it occurred to me, looking around at all your things and your work and going through years of work in my mind, that of all your work, you are still the most beautiful work of all. Thank you. Thank you, everybody. So, any questions? Yes?
I know you love to dance.
Yes.
Did you ever go to the dances in Philly, Wagner's or Shavu?
No, because I danced at the Woodbury Armory in South Jersey. But I knew about them. I mean, they were legendary. I didn't really have the money or the whereabouts to go to those dances, but they were famous. You know, I knew about them. And Philly dancers were good too, but you know, we were really good. We didn't have anything else. Anyone?
Hi. There's a million books written about the era that you came from, and of course, it's all third party. But in
the era that I came from.
Well,
you mean
you're.
You mean the protozoic era?
And
the Iron Age.
Cotton Sorry. Gin. No. One thing that runs through, I mean, maybe three quarters of them, is people feel comfortable for whatever reason taking really strangely nasty pot shots at you. I have no idea whether they're true or not, but most of them just seem really petty and stupid. Now, going through your book, you include two anecdotes, one with Tinkerbell and one with the Warhol guy,
mm-hmm.
which I very bracing. I was surprised they were in there. What I was wondering, those sorts of things, were they always, did you keep those on the surface through the years, or did you have to go back through journals and say, oh, yeah, her?
No, well, even in discussing Tinkerbell, I think I was compassionate. I wasn't using the book to have a vendetta. The poor girl took her own life, you know, so I don't think it's mean-spirited. And when I was speaking of how I felt about Andy, I was speaking from the perspective of a young girl. So, but it's not vindictive. I understand that Andy Warhol is one of the most important artists of the 20th century. But the world was a very mean world. And, but this book has no agenda against anyone. I would defy anyone to say there is anything mean, you know, purposely mean about anyone in this book. And in terms of how people, you know, the stuff that people write, I don't know. You know, sometimes when I was young, yeah, I could be an asshole, I guess. You know, that's part of being young. But I've read certain stuff, and I would say 70% of it is not true. And the true stuff is much cooler. I'm good, aren't I? Thanks. That was a good question. Thank you. Anybody?
Hi, Patty.
Hi.
I know when you were younger.
Pull the microphone a little away from your. It'll work better, like right
like
there.
Like this?
Yeah.
Okay. I know when you were around 17 or 18, you and your sister Linda had gone to Paris, and I know you at the time that's what you really wanted to do. And had you been to New York first or went to Paris or came back from Paris and went to New York?
Well, I mean, I went to New York in 1963 when I was 16. I mean, I snuck to New York, or once I saved my money with my friends and saw Nina Simone at the Village Gate. One of my professors took me to the Museum of Modern Art. I went to see the Empire State Building. So I had been to New York quite a number of times from as much as I could afford, you know, back then.
Yes.
It was about $2.50 for a round trip ticket. And my sister and I saved nearly a year to go to Paris. And it's very funny because you're sitting next to her. And thank you for that.
Linda. Okay, well, I just have one more thing. That is funny. That is very funny.
My sister is so cool. She's just sitting there like this.
I know. But and recently you've done a European tour this past summer and the one before that. Am I correct?
Yeah.
Okay.
So what's your question?
The question is...
I'm having a Chris Farley contact.
I'm sorry. Well, I'm a little nervous talking to you. Yeah. But anyway, do you think that when you were in Paris with your sister back in the 60s, did you ever think that you'd be doing a tour there like you just did?
Well,
hindsight?
I mean, the thing is, I had no aspirations to be a singer. I never imagined that I would make records or tour the world, and I'm certainly grateful that I have. Back then, I dragged my portfolio around with my drawings, hoping that one day my drawings would be shown in galleries or museums, and they have. So I got my wish. But the greater thing that happened, seeing the world and meeting people from all over the world through a rock and roll band, I never dreamed of that.
Thank you.
Any more? Yes?
Good. That's all.
Yes?
Hi, Patty. I'm back here. Hi. Sorry that I was late. I came in from New York. I had to stop at Strawberry Fields first because... I'm sure everyone knows today's the 30th anniversary of John Lennon's murder. But anyway, my question, I have so many questions for you, but my one question would be two parts. One, was it CBGB's or Max's Kansas City that you usually hung out at, and why?
Well, that would be a long question. Early, CBGB's didn't exist in 1969, and Robert and I used to go to Max's in 69 and 70 because it was Robert's wish to be part of that world and meet other artists and the Warhol contingent, and I went with Robert. And, CBGB's started in 1974 when television built the stage and started playing there. So it was a whole different era, and with whole different, went to Max's Kansas City to hang out, went to CBGB's to play music. So there was a different reason to go to either one of them. So, yes.
Thank you, Patty, first of all, for being here tonight for all of us.
I love coming to Philly.
It's wonderful. Such a love having you. You were very lucky to have Clive Davis take you into Arista Records. And to the way things are today, they tried to package people and put them
Believe me, it hasn't changed.
So that did happen, Clive, to you along your career. Did somebody try to do that to you?
They're still doing it. You just have to be, you have to know what you want. I mean, Clive, in all my years with Clive, he always said, I can offer you, there are two roads. You can do what you want and perhaps become a great artist or something, but either not successful or moderately successful. Or you do what I want and I'll make you a star. So he did offer me that, but I went my own way. And we did spar, but in the end, Clive let me do what I wanted. But, I had to be strong. For instance, the cover of Horses, they had airbrushed my hair. The original, they took Robert's picture and airbrushed my hair so it would be sort of like, it looked sort of like a Brett girl. And, and cleaned up any imperfections as if I wasn't totally imperfect in every way. So... But you have to be strong. You have to know what you want. If you want a career, if you want to be famous, you want to be a celebrity or any of that, you pretty much let other people guide you. you know, but if you have a real, your own vision, then you just follow your vision, you know, and make whatever sacrifices you have to make and fight the good fight. And either way is acceptable. I'm not putting down people if they want a different road, but that's never really attracted me. I mean, in the end, what I want to do is good work, because celebrity, fame, fortune, fun, but they fall away. People are not going to remember you 90, 100 years from now because you were a celebrity, but they'll remember if you give them good work. So. Yes? Oh. Right there. Here. Sorry to point.
Sorry about
that. That is not part of my upbringing. I remember my mother saying that. Don't point. Don't point. What if you were like one of those dogs, those pointer dogs? Yeah. Sorry. I know that was stupid. Sorry. Yes.
Hi, Patty. I want to thank you for not forgetting your roots, where you came from. It's a two-part question. What part of G-Town were you from?
G-Town?
Germantown.
Oh, I wasn't from G-Town. Well, my sister and I went to Henry Creese School, and we lived on Newhall Street. And we lived in sort of a little project on a field that was built for temporary housing for soldiers that came back from World War II. It doesn't exist now. I think there's a little park there
right now. Yeah.
And but that's where we were from.
Number two, what kind of effect did the punk scene back in the early 70s, mid 70s with, with Iggy Pop and them people, you know, the Velvet Underground. And
They didn't have any name for it, you know, the MC5 and Iggy and the Velvet Underground, you know, all of them were building a cultural voice, you know, that had to do with, you know, political engagement, revolution, sexual energy. It was a voice. You know, it wasn't limited to one genre. It was rock under the canopy of, was rock and roll. But the real important thing was a cultural voice, where we all spoke a similar language and were looking for the same thing. You know, new scenes, new noise, peace, you know, and a universal language through rock and roll. And so I don't think of it as like, you know, this whole thing people try to say, well, who was the first punk rocker? You know, it was Iggy. It was this person. It was, it was Mozart, you know. It was, who knows who it was? You know, who cares? You know, it's all, you know, we continue to build the canon of art and music and poetry, and the effect that those guys or those artists had on my particular band really was filtered mostly through Lenny Kaye. Because, you know, in growing up in South Jersey, I didn't even know those people existed. I didn't really know anything about the Iggy or the MC5 or the Velvet Underground till I came to New York. But Lenny Kaye in the late 60s, he was there in Detroit. He was writing about them. He was at their concerts. He was a real strong part of that world. And so Lenny's love of that world and understanding, comprehension of that world informed our band. So, and I did marry Fred Sonic Smith. Any more questions? Maybe one more?
Hello.
If you could sit one person down and make them listen to one album until they got it, who would the person be and what would the album be?
Let's see. Well, maybe I would take the most evil and most corrupt person imaginable and make them listen to A Love Supreme. Yes? Somebody's like, is somebody calling me? Do you have something you wanted to say or ask? He almost doesn't deserve to hear A Love Supreme.
Well,
are we good?
Yes. Thank you so much. Please
well,
join me in thanking
thank you, everybody.
Please join us upstairs for the book signing, which will start in just a few minutes.
Thank you for having me. And I love Philadelphia. Glad to be here.
Thank you for listening to this podcast from the Free Library of Great Conversations. If you live in Philadelphia or are planning a visit and would like to attend an author event, information on the series is available at freelibrary.org/authorevents.